Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
That's kind of competition between soul. That's competition between soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today, Kevin Schultz. Kevin's a professor and chair of the Department of History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we've invited him, as you all know, to talk about his excellent new book, Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, including white liberals. So, Kevin, thank you so much once again for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's turn to this really interesting chapter on radical chic, as well as positive polarization, where you discussed the beginning of last time we talked about civil rights and the emergence of the white liberal as a category, as like a very specific category with white attached to liberal, and then you get the criticism of it, a criticism that is what is Tom Wolfe, small c conservative? What are these people? They're very actually difficult to categorize. But why don't we talk about like where does this criticism come from? Why does it turn out to be so powerful? Where 40 years later, Bill Maher is still criticizing limousine liberals.
Yeah, it's a fantastic critique that emerges in the late 1960s and early 70s. And what's so interesting about it, at least to me, is that Tom Wolfe and others all the way to Bill Maher, they sort of still criticize liberals and liberalism for its policies, whether it's the use of bureaucracy and use of government power to temper the growth of capital, or foreign policy sort of initiatives that go sour a lot of the times. And instead of sort of taking a policy attack on liberals, beginning with Tom Wolfe, and we can go back, of course, there are predecessors, but Tom Wolfe really exemplifies this moment. They start criticizing liberals for their smugness and for their elite and aloof behavior and for being not part of the common American sort of project. And so Tom Wolfe's article on radical chic, you know, the whole thing starts with this dinner party, as he calls it. Leonard Bernstein called it a meeting, where a bunch of wealthy Upper East Side New Yorkers host the Black Panthers as a fundraiser for some of the Black Panthers to help them who had been arrested by the police for all sorts of civil rights or for speaking out publicly against some of the abuses that were happening. And all of a sudden they get aligned with this sort of radical moment, the Black Panthers. But here they are in this massive apartment on Park Avenue in New York overlooking the park. And so he draws this tension out, where all of a sudden you've got this irony of these wealthy New York elites who call themselves liberals and defend the liberal tradition. And here they are sort of pandering to these radical critiques that they themselves can't believe in. So it's this moment that he plays out in hilarity. It's a funny, funny piece, Radical Chic, that he writes. But the central point is to criticize white liberals for their sort of their cultural elitism. And from that moment on, all the way to Bill Maher today and on, this cultural elitism and this smugness becomes affixed to liberal identity.
Okay, so there's a couple of questions. One, is there an objective reality there? And two, where does that reality come from? Because usually, you know, Kevin, I've met some smug elite liberals in my time, particularly extraordinarily wealthy ones. And I mean, you could even think about someone like Bill Ackman, right? Like who just like anointed himself the king of anti-Semitism, right? By dint of no other thing than he's rich, smug, and a white liberal. So where does that, let's assume that there's some truth there. Where does that come from as a social phenomenon? Because that's pretty interesting, right? Like not every ideology, I mean, the communists have other things that you know, people associate with them. But where does this sort of smug eliteness come from in with liberalism? How does it become such a core feature of the affective world of the bourgeois liberal?
Look, you're absolutely right. There is a kernel of truth to almost all stereotypes, right? All stereotypes start with some kernel of truth, even if they become stereotypes and sometimes go on to malign this the tradition that they're supposedly defining. So yes, absolutely, there is this liberal component, or there is this elite component to a liberalism, whereby a lot of the elite and wealthy folks can continue to support liberal endeavors. Part of this stems from... to put it bluntly, racism, whereby a lot of the liberal project transitions through the 1960s to instead of supporting the white working class in the way the New Deal had, to supporting civil rights initiatives for brown and black Americans. And when that happens through the 1960s, with the sort of urging of liberals from especially latter-day JFK, but into the Lyndon Johnson administration for certain, all of a sudden, a lot of the white working class who had been liberals, who had been New Deal Democrats, they start feeling left behind and left out. So there is some truth to that. Now, we can have an interesting debate, and I think that it's an interesting and open question on whether or not the Democratic Party and or liberals really did leave behind the white working class in this moment. But what did end up happening was there was this critique amplified against them that the white working class was being left behind because now liberals were supporting black and brown people, civil rights endeavors, affirmative action, things along those lines, especially down to urban politics where there's sort of black and brown neighborhoods were getting more funding and the white ethnic neighborhoods were being left behind. So I think there is some truth and some tension that is going on there. But I do think what's really interesting with this Tom Wolfe piece and Kevin Phillips, of course, the political analyst who helps Nixon later, makes a similar critique where they're saying, ah, there's this tension here and we really need to amplify this critique. We really need to sort of make this image of the elite limousine liberal, of the radical chic, of their sort of out of touch aloofness, the key component that is what people think of when they imagine a white liberal.
So let's actually talk about that moment. I mean, is there truth to this abandonment of the white working class and the ethnic reaction that leaves like someone like Steve Bannon, who grew up in a Democratic family, like an arch Democratic family, to in 2025 basically be extraordinarily right wing? He would say, and I just don't know enough of the history for this to be for me to like really get into detail, that they in the 60s and the 70s, they abandoned the white working class for basically a bourgeois attachment to racial ideology, which Bannon would say they don't even really believe in anyway. And it was just a means to essentially hoard money. So what is going on there with this sort of the quote-unquote white liberal, which effectively at this point now stands in for bourgeois liberal. I think it starts with radical chic and continues to this day. Is there a truth to that political transformation, or is it much exaggerated and it's basically just become a right-wing talking point that doesn't reflect the empirical historical reality?
I think there is some truth to that, that the change of focus of liberals is a legitimate thing that takes place in the 1960s. Now, if you look at what the liberals are saying in the 1960s, a lot of your friends, these sort of post-World War II, post-war liberals, they're saying in part because the quantitative liberalism that really was designed in the 1930s and 40s, it worked. it elevated the poor white working classes to middle class status, where they're owning their own homes. They've got secure jobs, or at least relatively secure jobs, and they are on their way to middle class status. So now it was time to extend these efforts to people who had been left behind in this grand expansion that took place from 1930 to 1965, let's say. So I do think there is some truth to that, that there is a shift in focus in where liberal priorities and liberal policies go. On the other hand, I also think that the talking points that were coming from the right were exacerbated by things that were not put in place by liberals, such as the decline of manufacturing, which begins in the late 1960s, even earlier, depending on what geography you're looking at, and really picks up in the 1970s. And so if you're sort of a working class, sort of ethnic white person in New York, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, or something like that, you're nervously looking at the economy and you're seeing the government is attacking different problems. And so you're feeling that your security is under threat. So there is some legitimacy to what's going on, some of which is to the blame for liberal endeavors and some of which is not. And I do think the liberals and the Democratic Party were relatively inept at missing that point. There's this one point that I tell in my book where in about 1968, 1969, all the major magazines start writing about the forgotten white working class. Where is the great white working class going? These people are angry. What are they angry about? Every magazine covers the story. It's this moment, and it's really fascinating. And there's this one tell that really sort of shocked me when I found in 1968, there was this huge percentage of the population, the voting population, mostly white working class. And they were supporting Bobby Kennedy because he was sort of advocating policies that were going to bring the Democratic Party, not necessarily away from civil rights, but also to help the white working classes. And when Robert Kennedy gets killed, they all become Wallace voters. And so how do you trace this population that goes from supporting Bobby Kennedy to supporting George Wallace? And it reminded me of these people, you know, Joe Rogan and the likes, who did support Bernie Sanders in 2020, and then they go on to support Donald Trump in 2024. It's this great shift of this population where they're angry, frustrated, looking for creative ideas, and most of all, they don't want to feel forgotten. And so this moment sort of encapsulates that in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and it initiates this critique against what liberalism is, true or not.
And so how does Nixon and Agnew come into the story, and how do they take advantage of this for their own purposes? And so basically, I sent you my essay on Cold War liberalism. I kind of date the end of Cold War liberalism to 68 to 72. You know, it's the New Left and the Vietnam really beginning of the end, the turn to the quote-unquote urban crisis, which undermines a lot of the institutions of Cold War liberalism of the 50s and 60s, and then Nixon really puts the final bullet in the head of it, even though Nixon is still operating within a New Deal order. So that's what's in a way that I think Carter isn't. So there are complexities then to the story. Cold War liberalism effectively ends, but the New Deal order does not. It keeps on going for another, let's say, decade or so. But what do Agnew and Nixon do? And then we could talk about Schlafly and Wallace.
I think just to jump on Danny's question, we should talk a little bit about Kevin Phillips at this point and his contribution to this effort. He's an interesting guy to go
from.
Yeah,
we mentioned him, but yeah, let's go in detail.
Yeah, to talk a little bit more detail about him.
Yeah, Kevin Phillips, fascinating guy, very famous political analyst, but not in 1968 when he knocks on the door of the Republican Party and says, I've done some analysis of some of these electoral maps. And I think there's a way that we can create what his book is called an emerging Republican majority, gets released later. But this was his manuscript that he hands over. And part of his thesis is by studying these sort of electoral maps, what he realized is by portraying liberalism as a coastal elite phenomenon, the Republican Party could very easily win over all the states in the South and the Midwest and get the Lawrence Welkian American, is what he sort of called them later on, this sort of either lower middle class, working class, however we want to call them, or emergent middle class folks, especially white folks. And we could use them as a way to develop this emerging Republican majorities, he called it. And one of the key components, he says, let's not talk about New Deal policy, and let's not even talk about most policy at all, because most Americans buy into the liberal policies of New Deal and even some of the Great Society efforts. But instead, let's poke fun at this sort of cultural symbol of what the liberal is. Let's forget about winning New York. Let's forget about winning Los Angeles. Let's forget about winning San Francisco. We don't even want them. So let's not even go after them. But instead, let's use them, and this is his phrase, an agent of provocation. So let's go use them to sort of provoke the South and the Midwest voters to vote Republican. And they sort of follow the script in 68, and of course they win, and they realize they're onto something. Nixon at the time reads this manuscript, even though he denies to the press that he actually does read this manuscript, but he reads this manuscript, and in some of the notes to his staffers, he says, okay, follow the Phillips play perfectly, you know, do this kind of stuff, use the image of the liberal as a way to get our voters out. But he also at the time still wants to hold on to some presidential demeanor. And so Spiro Agnew, his vice president, sort of takes on the mantle of the bulldog in this. And he develops something that, Danny, you referenced earlier called positive polarization. And this is kind of a remarkable moment in American political history where you've got a sitting vice president who's going to actively engage in what he calls positive polarization, which is really developing a language of us versus them. And us is sort of the good, mostly white, working class, middle class American who believe in sort of traditional Christian values, as he calls it. And the them are the liberals, usually run by a university elite or a wealthy elite. And they're sort of the other side of this sort of vision of what anti-Americanism is. And so he then uses his great alliterative skills. I mean, he's a remarkable rhetorician where he uses all these alliterative skills to sort of set up a society that is situated between us versus them. And when he gets called out on this, he says, this is positive polarization. This is for the better for American life.
And so, what does this mean for the reshifting of conservative politics? I mean, you're a Buckley guy. Is this the institutionalization of Buckleyism, this anti-New Deal rhetoric? Is it actually not quite that? I mean, to be honest, what is Henry Kissinger if but a liberal? He is not. That is not a conservative guy, whatever nonsense he might have said. That is a classic 50s liberal. So you have like the foreign policy apparatus, particularly once Watergate gets going, essentially being run by Kissinger to a significant degree before. But Nixon is often, you know, imagined as this small C conservative. So like if we're going back like to the 50s and we're saying Buckley really founded the new movement, and I agree with that. How does Nixon relate to that anti-liberal reaction?
Yeah, in a way, he encapsulates the rhetoric of it without actually putting into place a whole lot of the policy or drive of the kinds of things Buckley was advocating. I mean, Nixon does not have a libertarian impulse. He does expand the scope of the government. He creates new agencies, environmental agencies. He expands the amount of money that goes to the NEH and the NEA. So he's still operating well within the liberal order, as Gary Gersel would call it. But he's using this rhetoric to ensure the Republican Party has this certain image of who it's representing and how they can be representative of what they start calling the common American. It doesn't pick up. He tries all these different phrases, and eventually he lands on this phrase of the silent American. And so that's sort of who he wants to be, as part of the silent majority. And that's who he wants to represent, even if his policies are not necessarily strikingly different from many of his predecessors in the Oval Office.
And let's talk about the more extreme end, Schlafly and Wallace, and how do they, because they really set the stage for the reactionary turn that we're living through right now in far right politics, or maybe it's not just far right, maybe it's just right wing. how do they play into this story as this reaction?
Well, they pick up sort of where Spiro Agnew left off. I have this analysis where the cultural politics become paramount, and Spiro Agnew is sort of the voice of a certain kind of cultural politics. And then Schlafly comes along and picks up another component of it, which is sort of the anti-feminist, the anti-women's liber kind of politics. She was sort of more of a, starting off as more of a sort of a hardcore conservative in a way that she really did want to overturn the New Deal order. Her famous 64 book that, or 63, 64 book that was sort of out to endorse Goldwater was called A Choice, Not an Echo. And, you know, the argument of that book, quite simply, is that she wanted the Republican Party to present the American people with a choice and not just another liberal, not just an echo of what the other party was doing. And so she was pushing forward all sorts of conspiratorial ideas in that book. It's quite a remarkable book if you go back and read it, about, you know, this sort of, she doesn't call them Jewish kingmakers, but she talks about the New York banking elite, who she calls kingmakers, and how they're the ones who are really controlling politics in American life. And we need to take our country back away from these people. So you can very easily read a lot of latent anti-Semitism into that kind of critique. But it really was a demand that there be a shift in the policy impulses of both parties, not just the Democratic Party. And she becomes famous, of course, a few years later for not necessarily any policy initiative that has to deal with the size of the government or anything like that. But again, it's pushing back against some of the cultural critiques. And she's most famous for her Stop ERA campaign, which successfully actually pushes back against the Equal Rights Amendment and its plausible passage, like it would have happened in the 1970s had she not sort of mobilized this movement. And one of the things she really does is, of course, there's antecedents, and there's plenty of great books about sort of feminist and homemaker conservatism in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But she really mobilizes that population, gives them a microphone and a way to amplify their critique, and really makes it a cultural critique about the role of women in American society. So they take this sort of critique that emerges with Tom Wolfe as sort of a way of imagining liberals. It's a cultural critique, not necessarily a policy critique, and amplifies it. And this really leads to that positive polarization that we were talking about with Spiro Agnew. And it's really become a foundation focal point for the Republican Party for the last 50 plus years.
And as well as just the racist reaction version of that, basically.
Yeah, in a way, a racist version, but also, you know, sort of creating a narrative that has some truth to it, that he's speaking for those who are unrepresented, who are not being heard, who are being sort of bulldozed over by the liberal elite as they go and do what it is that they will. So there is something that is definitely crass about his politics, which, you know, a lot of people are eager to castigate him for and chastise him for. But nonetheless, there was something to the magnetism of what he was bringing that was beyond just sort of a racist, crass racist politics.
So, Kevin, maybe we should move into the next chapter of the book, which is on losing liberalism, the end of the 60s and, the end of really this phase of the concept of liberalism in the 20th century. And I want to talk about the 1972 election and George McGovern getting tarred with the phrase acid amnesty and abortion by the guy who eventually ran as his vice president, which is fascinating, fascinating political history, but something that the Nixon campaign certainly seized on, and that became sort of the next iteration of the limousine liberal critique, is that all liberals are, you know, in favor of acid amnesty and abortion, which, you know, has stuck to the present day in many respects.
Yeah, fascinating moment in 1972, George McGovern running for president. During the buildup to the nomination, there were obviously several Democrats that were vying for the nomination to run against Nixon in 72. And a reporter was doing a story sort of interviewing a bunch of Democratic politicians, asking, you know, who they were going to support and what were the problems. And Senator Eagleton sort of comes up with this analysis that the real Americans, sort of tapping into this silent majority critique, the real Americans are never going to support George McGovern because he believes in the liberalization of drug laws, he believes in abortion, and he believes in amnesty for the Vietnam protesters. None of these positions were necessarily true, and none of them were even that radical, especially McGovern's own take on them. But he used this sort of alliterative phrase of acid amnesty and abortion, and it kind of got affixed to McGovern's campaign. And so throughout 1972, the Republican Party, looking for ways to market what they are and to tar the liberal agenda, used this as sort of a battering ram to show how distant he was from the American population. Of course, quite successfully, the Republicans and Nixon go on to win 49 states to one in the election. And part of why that is so successful is because it began this longstanding critique of blaming the 1960s as imagined by the Republican Party and a great number of white Americans and Black Americans, to be fair, blaming the excesses of the 60s, whether that was the growth of the bureaucratic state, whether that was perhaps being overly permissive when it came to affirmative action and certain things like that, and especially the Vietnam War and the turmoil surrounding the protests of the Vietnam War. And so all of us in the Democratic Party had to own the 1960s. And that was sort of a masterstroke, envisioning and picturing the 1960s in a certain way that had some truth to it, and then making the Democratic Party own all of the radicalisms and the exigencies of those, which, you know, there was some truth to that. Of course, there's a kernel of truth to that. But also, of course, in 1968, the Democratic Party is not embracing all the radical change. It's marching up and down State Street in Chicago, for instance.
Maybe we should talk about Daniel Patrick Moynihan for a second, just his place in all of this, because you do write about him in the book. And he strikes me as sort of the attempt at a counter-reformation, in a sense, of the Democratic Party. So let's talk a little bit about his position here.
Yeah, Moynihan's a fascinating person in this period, because what you see starting in 1968 is the Democrats are running from the label liberal. All of the candidates who are running in 1968 had been advocates or ardent adherents, self-proclaiming liberals. Many of them were writing books, you know, a liberal answer to the conservative agenda. They were giving speeches about how they were standing up for liberalism under its current attacks in the early 1960s. And 4 or 5 years later, by 1968, all of them are running from that label. And I could not find a single instance where any of the candidates, any of the four Democratic candidates running for president, called themselves a liberal. It may have happened. You know, it's a hard thing to say to disprove a negative, but it may have happened, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And so what you see by the late 1960s, early 70s, is all the Democrats are running from this label that 5, 10 years earlier, they had all been proclaiming and championing. It's just sort of this fascinating moment. And so in the mid-1970s, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, great New York intellectual, of course, who balances and bounces between academia and political life, he tries to resuscitate a version of liberalism that he calls intelligent liberalism. So we had quantitative liberalism, we had qualitative liberalism, we had Cold War liberalism. Then we have liberalism being mocked by the right and the left and by civil rights advocates. And now everybody's running from liberalism. Moynihan wants to sort of resuscitate this label as a useful way for the Democratic Party to talk about what it is they want to do. He puts out speeches, writes books on this kind of liberalism, and it's fascinating. It's sort of, he takes this two-prong approach. One, he wants to say, yes, the Democratic Party and its vision of liberalism needs to own the excesses of the 1960s. We were too bureaucratic. We were too permissive. We weren't listening to the white working classes who were complaining to us. So now we need to go back and reformulate a liberalism that addresses some of these critiques. That's the first part, owning the 60s. And then the second part he puts forward is sort of a socioeconomic policy-based kind of liberalism that advocates a floor for sort of an economic floor for most Americans and puts forward certain job programs. But it's not really an expansive kind of liberalism in the way the New Deal liberalism was. It's much more a liberalism with limits, is one of his phrases, where he wants to sort of limit the possibilities for what liberalism can do and what the Democratic Party should promise the American people. And in part, it made sense considering where we are. We're in the mid-1970s. We're watching deindustrialization happen. There's the oil embargo that's curtailing the expansion of the American economy. And so to go about making all sorts of expansive promises about what social democracy can do doesn't make that much sense. And so Moynihan is trying to sort of create this new version of liberalism throughout the 1970s. He was elected, you know, in New York, and he was a very successful and very prominent person in politics. But the label never really caught on, so much so that it's more or less forgotten by the time the 1980s roll around.
So to me, the big thing that happens to liberalism in the 60s is that so many people become neoconservatives, which is a profoundly liberal ideology. I mean, I think that the history of neoconservatism has not been properly understood as really in the history of liberalism, which is why you see with Trump the return of the neocons to they don't really have a home anymore, but they're trying to get back in the Democratic Party. And you gesture toward that a bit when you talk about like all these people like Bayard Rustin, Mitch Dechter, Gene Kirkpatrick, Nathan Glaser, Daniel Bell. A lot of those people, not all of them, I wouldn't call Brzezinski a neocon, but a lot of those people became neoconservatives at exactly this moment. How do you understand the transition from a Cold War liberalism to a neoconservatism in the middle of the 1970s and the shift away from the Democratic Party? I mean, obviously, on one hand, it's simple. They didn't like the Democratic Party. They didn't like the social revolutions of the 1960s. Also, the Dems were coming off as a bit like losers, particularly in the wake of McGovern. So they're going to try to align with, you know, Scoop Jackson, who would today be a Republican. But it's a really important shift, particularly what comes in the early 2000s. So I'm just curious, how do you understand that shift from a liberalism to a neoconservatism?
Yeah, what's fascinating is that after all of these historic losses in the 1970s for liberals in general, you get all these movements by all these people that you just rattled off, the Midge Dectors and things. And they're trying to resuscitate a liberalism in the late 1970s and the early 1980s. It's fairly similar in some ways to what Moynihan was trying to do, but they call it smart liberalism. They come up with their own phrasing for what kind of liberalism they're trying to revamp. And in part, this is because they're running from Nixon because of Watergate and because of some of the marketing issues that Nixon invites onto himself. But they also want to resuscitate what we today might call a classical liberalism, a 19th century liberalism. As I mentioned last episode, I think I resist this classical liberalism because liberalism has sort of a longer history than just a 19th and then a 20th century version. But nonetheless, it's this sort of very economic heavy, economic focused, economic friendly vision of liberalism. And so you get these neocons who found a home in the Democratic parties in the 1950s and even into the 1960s, who are worried about this move away from economic issues. They sort of see the decline of manufacturing and they want the Democratic Party to push back in meaningful ways. And they don't see the Democratic Party putting forward any initiatives to do that. And so they don't necessarily oppose a lot of the social issues and civil rights, especially as espoused in the early civil rights movement, where let's get these laws on the books that allow desegregation, for instance. They draw the line, of course, at things where government gets more active, such as affirmative action and schooling issues and things like that. And so they first, before they become neocons, they try to resuscitate a liberal tradition within the Democratic Party, and they all basically fall flat. They all more or less lose. There's an interesting argument one could make that they were just a little too early. It would come a little bit later when you've got Bill Clinton and the DNC coming and changing the Democratic Party's initiatives to be sort of more free market capitalism, along with sort of a social left kind of policy in certain ways. But nonetheless, these all fall flat and the Democratic Party doesn't reform itself. And like you were gesturing, Danny, they sort of lose. They're losers. The Democratic Party has no way to grab onto success. There's no foreseeable future for them. And they don't necessarily want to be part of the losing team, especially when it seems to be flailing so badly. Perhaps as I say that out loud, I might be thinking about what's going on in our own current times.
But what the Dems were able to do is they were able to reform themselves by essentially accepting the right wing critique. So let's turn to neoliberalism. And so how feel free maybe to talk a little bit about Foucault, but really how does this reshape what liberalism is?
Yeah, so the Democrats are out in the wilderness. Daniel Patrick Moynihan has tried to sort of revive this tradition, but with very limited success, especially outside his own purview. What's the Democratic Party to do? And in the late 1970s, early 80s, you get a bunch of sort of younger Democratic politicians. So in other words, by younger, I mean, they were not part of the Great Society. They were not part of the Vietnam War era. These people came after that. So they sort of are no longer tied to or affixed to the sort of acid amnesty and abortion critique where they need to own the 1960s. And they sort of suggest that, yes, the Democratic Party and the liberal tradition has more or less abandoned the American economic initiative and had gone after social issues and befriended people who were forgotten in the New Deal order. And we need to challenge that, or else we're just going to be in a line of 49-1 state losses for presidential elections for the foreseeable future. What's interesting about their critique in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, however, and I'm talking about Charlie Peters and this sort of group of young politicians that are emerging, Bill Bradley, for instance, some guy named Bill Clinton, Al Gore, even a guy named Joe Biden was at some of these meetings. And they call themselves neo-liberals. So they're the neoliberals, but with a dash in it. The dash is important to differentiate them from the neoliberals, that another tradition that's coming out of Hayek and sort of a more conservative economic tradition, even though there is some overlap, which we can talk about if you want. And what they see is that reviving American manufacturing is not going to happen. This is their argument in the 1970s and 1980s. But we can't forget about economic issues. So instead, the energy of American economic life, in their argument, and it proves out, is in technology. It is in sort of the Silicon Valley embrace. It is in these sort of tech hubs. And that's where the American economy needs to be positioned. So they put forward a bunch of really business-friendly, policy-friendly ideas that will allow the tech world to expand in the United States. And they put forward other initiatives, too, that are kind of fascinating.
And everything worked out perfectly.
Exactly. So they called them Atari Democrats, talking about the game console, the very popular game console of the 1980s, because these were a bunch of Democrats who were not your sort of labor left Democrats, but these were the tech bros who were going to come and say technology is the way for the economic future of the United States. Let's bet on tech. And they really started to ground the Democratic economic policy in this initiative. They didn't succeed in the 1980s, at least under that label of neoliberal. But that critique carries over into the DNC of the later 1980s and into the 1990s. And of course, it becomes a foundational component of Bill Clinton's third way.
So this to me is really crucial, because I think what this demonstrates, even though I disagree with the policy move made, is that the Democratic Party and self-identified liberals are actually able to incorporate to critique. There was stagnation in the New Deal order in the Fordist economy, and they felt, reading what they were understanding at the time, again, I think they were naive about what they were doing, but they incorporated criticism, which would essentially enable them to deal with Reagan and eventually emerge triumphant in the 1990s or really complete the Reagan project. Why do you think they were able to do that in such an effective way, to embrace the protean element of liberalism?
Ah, yes. I love this question. And you answered your own question. It's a protean element of liberalism. So, of course, it goes back to the definition of liberalism, which is to promote freedom as much as you can while balancing that with a social commitment to equality, because if there's not some leveling in society, then certain people will be unfree by definition. And because this is sort of this amorphous spirit, liberalism, it is able to change with the times, to attack whoever it is that is trying to curtail individual freedom and or equality that will enable those individual freedoms to succeed. So liberalism, this is why I'm pushing back on people when they say, oh, I hate liberals, or the liberals are this, the liberals are that. Well, which liberal are you talking about is always my first question. Define your vision of liberalism. And it's because of this protean quality. So it's not surprising at all that liberalism is able to shift what it is depending on who is presented as the key problem. So in this moment, they see a certain liberalism, New Deal liberalism, or quantitative liberalism, or even qualitative liberalism, or great society liberalism, or post-war liberalism, as an idea that is premised on sort of economic expansion. And so starting in the 1970s, 1980s, we need to develop a liberalism that is premised and enacted on an economic sort of contraction or an economic shift on where that level of expansion is. So instead of finding the sort of voice of liberalism in labor unions and manufacturing, the UAW or something like that, we're going to have to find the voice of liberalism in what turns out to be an educated elite in Silicon Valley that is going to promote a certain kind of free market economy. So it's not surprising to me that liberalism is able to shift its course and shift its sort of focus. What is surprising is that they were willing to curtail certain elements of its previous iteration, including its commitment to sort of the white working class. They sort of explained this away in their own terms, that this was going to be, you know, rising tide will lift all boats, and there'll be this shift away. You need to get re-education kind of components where we're training former warehouse workers into coders, basically. and this new economy is going to be where an expansion can happen for all. Those policies, as we now know, looking back, fall relatively flat and leads to this great divide in American economic inequality.
So let's go on to the 90s and a chapter you call Owning the Libs, which is really about the emergence of this extraordinary conservative reaction to a group of neoliberals who seem to embrace a lot of actually conservative ideas and ideology, which to me needs to be explained. So there's a lot there, but we could talk about Limbaugh. We could talk about, you know, all of the 90s criticisms of liberals and how that basically created the cultural world in which we're still living today. The beginning of the slide into Nazi symbology.
Yes. So this chapter, I sort of where the book began, at least in my brain several years ago, was how does this language of owning the libs become so prominent in right-wing talking points and so effective? And so that was sort of the launching point of this book, going back in time and figuring out sort of the roots and the origins of this. And our current times, I trace it back to sort of, there's three elements on the right that really sort of master this critique of owning the libs. And it is the politicos, the politicians, when you've got Ronald Reagan, who's really talking about the L word, the dreaded L word, and claiming Michael Dukakis is a liberal, and he needs to own this identity and all of the evil manifestations that we've given it. So you've got this political critique. It meets up with this religious critique of the what we today call the religious right, whereby you've got the enemy is secular liberalism and these women's liberal libs who are trying to change our definition of family and traditional family values. And that meets up with the right wing, the emergence of right wing media, which is the Rush Limbaugh that you're talking about, all the way to the Don Bonginos of today and this sort of huge right wing media sphere, where the key unifying theme, I would argue, is sort of owning the libs and this sort of fascination with anti-liberalism. So this last chapter of Owning the Libs details all three of these rivers as these are streams as they come together to become what is in our time sort of the dominant critique. There's so many fascinating things that come up in this realm. And one of it is that they sort of continue the critique where they make the libs own the 1960s. So they're responsible for that kind of bureaucratic, expansionist government, sort of New Deal, Great Society liberalism. And then they tap into the fact that they use this elitist argument that really starts with Tom Wolfe and the limousine liberals and has its origins in the late 1960s and 1970s. And they use that to make the liberals also own neoliberalism. It's this fascinating moment where liberals have to take on the expansion of the government and the growth of the bureaucratic state, but then also the reaction to that, which is neoliberalism. It's sort of a masterful political move. And what I found when I was studying these is that the real constitutive glue, the only constitutive glue of these sort of various strands of conservatism is their hatred of libs, their hatred of the liberals. I was going through reading all sorts of analyses of the 2016 election, of the 2020 election, and the 2024 election. And you would sort of read these interviews with people saying, oh my goodness, Donald Trump is doing all of these horrible things, mocking a disabled reporter. How on earth could you possibly continue to vote? And they're like, you guys are such idiots, these reporters. You don't understand. All Trump is about is owning the libs, is mocking these people who are making our lives more difficult. And so we don't really care what he does. And what's fascinating is what we do care about is your response to what he does. Because that just confirms our point that the libs are all worried about all the wrong things. They're not really interested in making life better for us. And so this is the central glue that is keeping us together and sort of powering this movement.
And so the thing I kind of agree with Adam Tooze here is that it can be meaningfully rejected, understood as a rejection of the professional managerial class, which has become identified almost synonymous with liberalism, which was not true for the entirety of the history of liberalism. So I'm curious, what do you think, to maybe bring it a little bit closer today, about that association of professional managerialism with the Democratic Party, and thus with liberalism? And I would say accurately that there is the Democratic Party has become efficiently PMC'd in a way that the Republican Party just is not in any meaningful way, which is it was kind of occluded with the Harris-Waltz ticket, because those Waltz at least wasn't really PMC. Harris, though, absolutely was. So it's a little outside the scope of the book, but to me that is why the Owning the Libs has such power today, and that people who would have formerly been Democrats really loathe the Democratic Party because they loathe professional class managerialism. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, two thoughts jump out right away. One is, yes, I think that is true. And that's provided sort of the growth of MAGA America and the Trump revolt, is that, you know, the most popular politician in America right now, judging by polls, is Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders is voicing a certain critique that is speaking to a lot of the white working classes who are angry and frustrated with the current neoliberal order. And the fact that he, in 2020 and 2024, was sort of summarily removed from the running in the Democratic ticket, it just amplifies the critique that it is this managerial class that is controlling who represents us. And if you don't feel like you're being heard, you're going to be frustrated, you're going to be angry, and you're going to look for somebody who's going to hear you. And that has been one of the talents of Donald Trump and MAGA America, is that he purports to be speaking for these certain people, and he goes and works at McDonald's for a day, you know, and it's ridiculous and it's easy to mock, but there's something that is very visually appealing to certain people. The other part that I'll talk about is a little different from this critique, but it's William's critique in White Working Class, this book that she wrote about why the white working class has been so sort of gravitated so far to the Republican Party. And it's in part because the Democrats haven't really proposed very many economic solutions to the decline of security that the white working class is feeling. And the Republicans, right or wrong, have at least proposed something, which is free market capitalism. Let's open up the markets. Let's get rid of regulation. Let's see what can happen. Now, we know what happens is that a lot of the wealth and a lot of the capital gravitates towards the top. It doesn't necessarily pan out the way that people want it to pan out. But nonetheless, this at least is an economic policy that is appealing to people. Meanwhile, the Democrats don't have any answer at all. It's more regulation, more bureaucracy, more government. And that really hasn't been proven to be successful or really compelling to a lot of people.
So I think this leads naturally into the concluding section of the book. And I just want to say I appreciate that you started this section off with the live West Wing debate, which is one of the most absurd things I think I've ever seen in my life. But it's reflective of a moment. And you cite the part of the debate where you got Alan Alda is playing the Republican candidate. Jimmy Smits is playing the Democratic candidate. And Alan Alda kind of, you know, slams him as an unthinking liberal. And Jimmy Smits goes into this monologue about liberals did, you know, all these things. He lists all these accomplishments. And this is reflective of a moment, I think, where liberals like Aaron Sorkin got frustrated with being tarred as liberal, or that word being used in a negative context. And we're like, okay, you're going to call me a liberal? Fine. Here's what I think about liberalism. But the thing is that all the accomplishments he lists are like at least 30 years old by that point. There's nothing in that list that is in any way contemporary. And it's reflective, I think, of the fact that liberalism, after the Clinton period, let's say, when it incorporated the neoliberal ideas into it in response to a critique, it has since lost the ability to respond to critique, which is how you get to this point where people feel like they're just not speaking to my lived experience. So with that in mind, I think your suggestion here is we're at the point where we need to try something else. And what could that be moving forward?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, one of the key developments of this book was watching people like Aaron Sorkin or Hillary Clinton when she was running for president try and come up with a label to describe what it was she wanted to do, which maybe was not expand the government, expand the bureaucratic state, but put in place a government that was going to be more instrumental in helping the lives of the middle class in the United States, but there was no way for her to describe it. So Aaron Sorkin is incredibly frustrated. The word liberal has been tarred so much. They actually tried to tar Hillary Clinton in 2007, 2008 with the label liberal, And she says, no, I'm not a liberal. That word has been too maligned. I prefer to call myself a progressive. Well, progressive has a brief moment. There are progressive clubs that get formed all over the country, Facebook groups and things like that. But it doesn't really take off as a label that anybody uses. So towards the end of the book, I start sort of riffing through a bunch of possible terms by which a left or even a center-left coalition might find a useful word to describe themselves, since liberal is basically broken and too tarred. And I go through sort of a labor party, which that doesn't really work as well anymore because of the decline of union labor. I go through a progressive party that sort of got some historical baggage that doesn't necessarily carry weight in the United States. I sort of hold out hope, although I'm not super optimistic, that the label social democracy will come back into vogue. It never really had a history in the United States, which will actually be to its advantage. It has more of a European history as a center-left coalition, although it's declining in Europe right now. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean it's going to have parallel fortune here in the United States. So I'm holding out hope that maybe there's this language of social democracy that will come back as a way for politicians to describe the sort of individualism of democracy, you know, one vote per person kind of thing, and a commitment to the social and a commitment to society, where things sort of broke down. So there might be a language to provide that kind of balance between freedom and equality, which had been called liberalism in certain iterations in the past. Now there's no word to describe that sort of coalition. So we'll see if it comes to fruition. I'm not optimistic, but it would be great if there was a way to have meaningful discussion, at least serious political debate, in the United States. It was super fascinating watching the last 5 years, basically from the moment when Barack Obama was trying to describe his economic policy, and he's talking to some of these the sort of economic elite, and he's telling them that they didn't build the roads, they didn't build the university, you didn't build that. But he had no way to describe what it was that he was trying to put forward. You see that in all the way Joe Biden's policies, where he's trying to put forward the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure bill. But a lot of these are liberal initiatives to promote environmentalism, to shift the manufacturing base and bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. There are more manufacturing jobs in the United States at the end of Joe Biden's presidency than at the beginning of his presidency. These are in places where that are not voting for him, traditional red states where they've had severe economic decline. But he doesn't have a way to put it. He actually concedes that he failed to market his policies well. You get Kamala Harris sitting on top of a coconut on New York Magazine because you didn't fall out of that coconut tree by yourself. There's no language for the left or the center left to describe what it is they want to do. Liberalism is broken. What's going to come next? I don't know.
And that also relates, and then we've got to go, but to just the gerontocracy of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is actually much worse than the Republican Party in terms of foster. Like, if you look at the party rules, I looked into this a few years ago, they make it much more difficult to basically anoint younger people, which is a significant problem. And then if you're going to have a new language and framework, you definitely need people who are younger. But that's a conversation for another time. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone read his Why Everyone Hates White Liberals, including White Liberals. It's a really excellent book, and we'd love to have you back again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much, Danny and David. Or Derek. Thank you so much,
Danny. I call him David, too. Honorary Jew.
Yeah,
I'm going to start calling you David, Derek.
Thank you so much. I'm honored.
But thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. It was a super fun conversation.
No, it was great. Thanks.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.